From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Lansing City Council agrees to consider a substantial defunding of the police department.
Only 5% of calls responded to are violent crime. So why do we need the other 95% of the police force? That's my question.
We'll speak with the author of the plan. Also, a Supreme Court decision on tribal sovereignty ripples across a similar case in Michigan, and we review the state's history with the death penalty.
Michigan was unique in the sense that it was the first to abolish capital punishment and stood alone for a long time.
And a bonus, former FBI agent based in Detroit tells crazy stories from the drug wars in a new podcast.
You know, I wasn't running around in Ferraris and white suits. A lot of stress, a lot of problems, a lot of things could go wrong at any minute.
Marijuana, motorcycles, and mayhem coming up this hour. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're going to hear about how a recent Supreme Court decision on treaty rights might affect one Native tribe's lawsuit against the state of Michigan.
This was one of the rare, maybe the only times where the court actually paid attention to and gave respect to how a case like this would impact Indian people.
But first, last night, Lansing City Council heard public comments on a proposal to cut police funding by 50% over the course of the next several years. Lansing is only one of several cities in Michigan where citizens have been asking for tangible solutions to excessive use of force by officers. Lansing City Councilman Brandon Betts believes the solution is this substantial reduction in funding. He joins us now. Brandon Betts, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
So the phrase defund the police gets used a lot, and it means different things to different people. Can you tell us what it means to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's, you know, this scary thing with defunding that everybody's really worried about. But what defunding really is and what it is in practice is a reinvestment in our community in a way that makes our community safer. So the way to think about this is there are root causes to crime. We know what they are. People with lower incomes are likely to cause crimes because they need it. You know, we've got people with mental health issues that police respond to on the daily for different things. We can replace police with services and with programs that allow us to reduce our police department, in essence, because there will be less crime. It actually makes our community safer to go in this direction, as opposed to having police that just respond to crimes after they've already happened.
Could you lay out how the proposal would work, the sort of the timeline that you have in mind?
Yeah, absolutely. So the resolution that we passed on council was what is allowable. So right now, the resolution is only calling for a committee to be put together to investigate what defunding the police department would look like over 5 years, specifically 50% of the police department, because we do have pension costs, we do have contracts and things like that that we still have to meet over the next 5 years. But the goal of this is really to start investigating what services and what programs we need to start investing in as a city to make sure that this is a successful transition into a safer community, which is my goal. And when people talk to me about safety, well, one thing that I like to note is that our Black and Brown residents in this city are not safe from police. They are three times more likely to be pulled over and arrested on the spot, according to police data in Lansing. They're more likely to be pulled over. They're more likely to be confronted by police. And we've had violent interactions with police, with people of color in Lansing. Last year, there's a 16-year-old girl who was beat up by a police officer when that person could have been talked to by a social worker and calmed down and referred to services, like should have happened, as opposed to the police being called on a 16-year-old girl. So the point of my resolution is to start investigating this and to start the conversation, because thus far the mayor hasn't been willing to start that conversation. And so I think it's upon council to start investigating these issues.
What conversations have you had with Mayor Shore about this?
So far, Andy has been quite hesitant. Black Lives Matter Lansing has reached out to them, as well as a bunch of the Black community. And this issue has been going on in the mayor's office for a long time. But the truth of the matter is he has not been willing to step up to the plate on this issue. He's not ready for change, and he's not ready to look at a future that protects our Black and Brown residents. And I think that that is, in part because of the political background that he comes from, but it's also because he's white. And I think that that's something that has been an issue moving forward. And obviously, we need the mayor on board with this, which is the reason why I've proposed that we as council put together a report to start researching this. Because as long as the mayor's not going to do something, we need to do something. We need to act in this moment. And the answer is for council to act.
Mayor Andy Shore is someone with whom, you know, we might say the buck stops with him in terms of police budgets. But he's also the guy who has to get up in front of the cameras whenever there is a particularly violent incident in town, maybe something like an active shooter situation. Do you think that you and he are under different kinds of pressure and have different kinds of accountability in this situation?
There are two questions baked in there, and I'll answer both of them. First, Andy and I are different people. My goal in council is to make sure that there's racial equity for all citizens in Lansing. And that means listening to the Black community who is calling for the defunding of the police. The buck stops truly when the community starts calling for change, and the community has called for change. And it's time for Andy to stand up and look and see what those changes are. Now, your question is, what about violent crime? What about these mass shootings? I'm not suggesting that we get rid of public safety. There are so many people who think this is what we're talking about. No, we need some form of public safety, but that form of public safety is not the police, because the police, the amount of violent crime that happens nationwide, only 5% of calls responded to are violent crime. So why do we need the other 95% of the police force? That's my question, and the question that I hope we get to answer on council, and something that I think that we as society need to be investigating. I'm not suggesting that we let shooters run around the streets and kill a whole bunch of people. I'm suggesting that we have a better form of public safety that actually keeps our Black and brown residents safe.
You've received any number of Facebook comments in which people threaten to recall you because of your advocacy on this matter, or at least challenge you for your council seat. Would you say you've received more supportive comments or negative ones about this?
Absolutely. Facebook warriors are a thing, but you look at the people who are showing up to council, you look at the people who are coming to me and actually speaking to me about this issue, plus people on Facebook have been positive to this thing. What I've seen is the people who are reaching out live outside of the city or are uneducated in what's going on. And the one thing that I ask for everybody is that you get educated, because times are changing and it's time to get with the movement, because this is a civil rights movement. This isn't me defunding the police. This is me working to listen to the Black and brown communities who have called very specifically for this to happen as part of a large international civil rights movement that is truly trying to protect Black lives.
Should we worry about how this might affect police recruiting? If this plan were to go into effect, obviously the department will not be exactly on a hiring spree in years to come. But when you think about the police force of the future, downsized to what you think is an appropriate level of staff, would people want to take public service jobs with a department whose budget has been cut by half?
In the long term, the hope is to have no police budget. The hope is to have a different form of public safety. That means people who protect us that are not sworn police officers, because police are truly a racist institution. They're derived from slave catchers. And we need to realize that that's the fact. There is structural racism in our police department, and we need a completely different way of doing things. No, I don't think that people in public services are going to be worried about their jobs. What I tell people about the unemployment issue is that structural unemployment is part of systemic change, and it's healthy. Economists everywhere say that structural unemployment is important. I think that we should retrain police officers to do something else other than being police officers, because police officers truly are violent to our Black and brown communities. And this is the only answer that we have to fix this problem.
Lansing, being the state capital with a history in manufacturing and near a major university, is probably one of the more diverse and integrated communities that we can look at in the state. But there are still neighborhoods in Lansing that are more Black or more white. Do you think that Lansing is seeing Black neighborhoods that are more heavily policed or just policed in different ways, that difference is becoming more obvious?
I live in a majority white neighborhood, and I have seen two police officers drive on my street in the last 3 years that I've lived here. Whereas in my ward, there's a neighborhood called Baker Denora that is predominantly black, and there are police patrolling those streets 24 hours a day. And the term that they use is, you know, we're protecting public safety, but they aren't. They're looking to arrest black people because that is what happens when all you do is patrol black neighborhoods. It's so wrong to me that that's how policing works. There isn't more crime in black neighborhoods because those people are black. There's crime in black neighborhoods because there is a lot of need in that community that we can answer through investments in our community. And that means, again, defunding our police department and taking that money and reinvesting it.
Will you tell us more about what you think should be done with the money that would not be spent on police if these plans move forward?
I am going to sit here and say that the answer needs to come from the community. I am not the person to answer that question. And that is the reason, again, why I've put together this committee to investigate this. Because I think that we need community input. We need our black and brown neighbors to come out and say, hey, these are the things that we need invested in so that we can change society and be a safer society. This isn't something that I have the answer to. This is something that we as a community, as an entire community in Lansing, need to come together and talk about. And that is the discussion that I truly want to have. Defunding is the misnomer of the situation. It's something that people don't entirely understand. What I want to talk about is where we can spend that money in our city to make our city truly safer and more equitable for everybody who lives here.
Brandon Betts represents the first ward in Lansing. Brandon, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Of course. This was a great conversation. I love having it. And I'm really happy to have met you and to be talking to you about this.
Same. Coming up, attention true crime fans and Michigan Files. There's now a one-stop shop for your listening needs.
Up until then, the DEA had been kind of doing some busts, but they weren't as big and they weren't as well-equipped as the FBI was. And so they knew the FBI had busted the mob, and they said, hey, why don't you guys start infiltrating these drug cartels? And Ned was at the very forefront of this.
It's the Wild West of the 1980s drug trade in Detroit, seen through the eyes of one FBI agent. That story's up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. A federal agent walks into a biker bar looking for a country singing fugitive. This is not the setup for a joke. It's the story of FBI agent Ned Timmons and the drug investigation that led from Detroit to South America and ultimately to the downfall of one head of state. With us to tell us about it are Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author who produced the series, Jake Halpern. Jake, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also with us today, Ned Timmons, the longtime Detroit FBI agent who was at the center of all of this, now retired. Ned Timmons, it's very good to have you on the show as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, April.
Deep Cover starts out with a rather startling anecdote that I'm afraid we cannot share in its fullness in a family public radio format. But suffice to say that you kick off this narrative letting us know that Ned is a widely traveled person of varied interests. Ned, will you tell us a little bit about your background in law enforcement in Detroit at circa the time that all of this began?
Well, prior to the FBI, I did 3 years in the Army, assigned to the CID in Korea. And I did 10 years as a police officer in Oak Park, Michigan, and then joined the FBI in 1981.
Why would you say that undercover work was appealing to you?
Well, Jake and I have talked about this, but I think when you are embedded with a motorcycle gang or with a drug cartel, like in the Cayman Islands, it's an ultimate acting assignment, and you have to size up who you're dealing with and deal with all of them different, whether you've got a rough biker or you're dealing with someone that's more civilized, you know?
Yeah. Jake, will you tell us the story of how you and Ned met?
Yeah, it, you know, my 20 plus years of journalism, it was one of the more bizarre ways that I got onto a story. But I got a call from a friend of mine who had gotten a copy of an unpublished novel. He just said, written by a former FBI agent, and would I take a look at it? And so he sent me this PDF, and I started reading through it. And it was the story that you outlined in the intro about this guy who goes undercover in the biker gangs in the 80s and infiltrates this drug smuggling network. And it sets off a sequence of events that result in the toppling of a dictator and the invasion of a foreign country. And I kind of read through this and I call back my friend out in LA and I say, so what's the deal with this book? Is this fact or this is fiction? And he said, you know, as far as I know, it's pretty much all true, which I found, you know, difficult to wrap my head around and believe. And I said, well, let me talk to this guy. Let me meet this guy. And that's when I first connected with Ned and started kind of asking him about this story. And we had this conversation and I said, Ned, if I'm going to turn this into a nonfiction podcast, we're going to have to fact check this rigorously. And I'm going to need to talk to basically every single person that you mention here.
Yeah. Could you describe for us, I guess, maybe Ned, what was your view on the corner of the global drug trade from the point of view of Detroit?
Well, obviously, Detroit is a major drug market, as all of the big cities are. In this particular situation, the people involved in the smuggling operation had a aviation operation where they flew over 200 airplane loads, mostly Queen Air size airplane loads into Michigan, direct from Columbia, nonstop. And they also operated shrimp boats and barges where the shrimp boats would haul 40 to 60,000 pounds of marijuana and assorted amounts of cocaine. And the barges would haul 150,000 pounds up to 1 million pounds that they were planning when we arrested everybody.
Ned, could you explain how you were asked to take on this undercover assignment?
Well, I was working on the bank robbery and fugitive squad and arrested this biker. And obviously, you know, the FBI is always interested in the bigger picture. And any major arrest I made, I always wanted to see where we could climb to, how we could climb the ladder or what was there. And it just happened that this one fugitive was able to introduce me to another guy who introduced me to a third guy who happened to be embedded in the smuggling operation. And it was fortuitous that he ran in what they call a PSE machine, which is a Vietnam era polygraph of questionable quality. And he ran that and he tested all the people involved. You know, if they brought in a shrimp boat load, they might have 25 or 30 bad guys involved in it. If they brought in a barge, that could have up to 100 guys involved. And he tested them all to see if any of them were working for the government, et cetera. But it was unique in the fact that this is one of the few guys in the organization that knew everybody. Even the top guys didn't know everybody, but this guy did. He knew from the lowest bail thrower to boat guys to truck drivers to everybody involved. And we spent years, you know, identifying everybody and building a case on everyone.
Now, I don't want to break the flow of where this is going, but I just want to stop for a moment and note that, again, Jake, part of your job in putting together the podcast was going back and finding sources for these things that Ned is describing. What was your experience investigating this story?
Well, you know, like any journalist, I'm always skeptical. I mean, I don't trust anyone, sometimes including even myself. And so I had a conversation very early on with Ned, which was that, you know, this isn't personal, but I'm not going to be able to take your word for anything. And so early on, he produced a biker who we didn't end up, in the end, wouldn't go on record because he was worried about the repercussions, but who pretty clearly right away started verifying a lot of the things that Ned was telling me. The other amazing thing about this story is Ned was married to a woman named Kathy at the time who was also an FBI agent. And I started talking to Kathy. And Kathy basically
had this great perspective because she was living with Ned. She was watching Ned go through this incredible ordeal of going deep undercover in biker and then drug cartels. So she saw it as his wife, but she also saw it as an FBI agent. And she actually even sometimes on a few occasions goes undercover with him to the biker bars. So Kathy ended up being this great other perspective on the whole narrative. But at every step of the way, I needed to verify it. And in the end, I tracked down, there were three kingpins involved in this smuggling cartel. And in the end, I managed to track down all three of them and interview all of them. I mean, it took a year and a half, and some of the interviews came in late, but yeah, I was able to kind of verify what I present to the listeners in the podcast. And the other thing, can I just say one more quick thing? Just a bit of historical context here. When Ned first gets onto this case, it's hard to imagine this, but in the 80s, the US government was just starting to realize just how sophisticated and elaborate these drug smugglers were. And up until then, the DEA had been kind of doing some busts, but they weren't as big and they weren't as well equipped as the FBI was. And so they knew the FBI had busted the mob and they said, hey, why don't you guys start infiltrating these drug cartels? And Ned was at the very forefront of this. So when he gets this biker who basically flips and brings him in, Ned is kind of early in, first boots on the ground of an FBI guy infiltrating the cartel. And the scale of what he starts to discover is so much bigger than anything that people can wrap their head around at the time that it's really pretty groundbreaking.
Well, Ned, what was the point at which you yourself realized just how far this case might go?
Well, we were doing smaller cases with these bikers that began cooperating. We did a 30-station meth lab out in Bakersfield, California, which was the largest meth lab at the time ever busted. We were doing 10 and 20 key deals in California and in Washington, D.C. And I kept hearing about planes flying nonstop from Columbia to northern lower peninsula Michigan. And it was hard for me to believe. Again, the FBI was just getting into the drug business. And it's like every arrest, we heard more and more about this gigantic operation that involves ships and barges and shrimp boats and airplanes and DC-6s. I kept hearing about it. And pretty soon, I said, well, there's something to this.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guests are Ned Timmons, former FBI agent based out of Metro Detroit, and Jake Halpern, best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. They are the voices behind the new podcast Deep Covered from Pushkin Industries. Ned, through the course of this investigation and a very elaborate process of playing both sides, you reached this point where you were getting closer and closer to General Manuel Noriega, the former head of state for Panama. Did you ever actually come in contact with him?
I never met him in person. When I was undercover in the Cayman Islands, I worked basically for one of the top three people in this organization. And he referred to him as Pineapple Face and the General. And you got to realize that, as far as I know, this was the first time they'd sent an FBI agent undercover outside of the United States. That was all DEA and CIA territory. So it took a lot of effort by Washington and a lot of effort by headquarters. We had to deal directly with Scotland Yard in London to get permission to operate in the Cayman Islands. But I was already out of the country, and we'd already stretched the bounds of FBI headquarters. And when I got a message back that they wanted me to meet with Noriega, I think it overwhelmed them. And the other problem is that the rules of the game are, you just like when we went into Cayman, we had to tell Scotland Yard, okay, there's going to be an FBI agent undercover in Cayman, May, June, or July. And that's all they would tell them, because we knew we had all kinds of leaks in law enforcement in the Cayman Islands. So to operate by the rules of the road, we would have had to tell somebody in Panama that an undercover agent was coming in. And you couldn't do that. The president and his whole staff of generals were involved in the money laundering and the drug trade and trading intelligence. And it was a very precarious situation, too, because Noriega was very close to Castro, and Castro very close to the Russians. So then you're entering CIA territory. And it got very complicated. Anyways, and I could see that headquarters balked at, you know, setting up a meeting with Noriega in person.
Right. Without giving away too much of what happens in the podcast, and there is a lot, Jake, could you talk about what the tipping point was for the U.S. to finally take action on the issues that Ned was investigating?
Yeah, so what happened was is that for a number of years, the United States government had a close working relationship with General Noriega down in Panama. And we perceived him as our ally in the fight against communists. He actually received a number of letters of commendation, including from the Drug Enforcement Agency, who saw him as an ally in the war on drugs. But what Ned's investigation does is it fuses with a few other federal investigations. And as Ned works his way up the kind of ladder of this smuggling syndicate, it becomes clear that one of the silent partners and key players in this all is none other than Noriega, that he was facilitating money laundering by this cartel on a large scale. He was allowing the smugglers to fly in money, be picked up at the airport by limo, being brought directly to the bank, and he was profiting from it. So after the arrests, there are congressional investigations, and this guy, Stephen Kalish, who was the smuggler who was closest with Noriega, testifies that Noriega was basically my partner. So this is hugely shocking, right? Because here's this ally that's supposedly helping us fight the communists and fight the war on drugs, and in fact, he's lining his pockets with drug profits. So then this drug trafficking claims against him becomes our excuse for going down to Panama, invading and capturing this guy. It's unclear whether, you know, the cynic would say we were looking for an excuse to depose a dictator who had become, you know, unfriendly and an embarrassment to us. The patriot who wants to see it with wide eyes would say, well, this was a bad guy and we went down and get him. And we try to do a careful job in the podcast of letting you, the listener, come to your own conclusion about what you think was happening.
Right. Guys, the literature around undercover work often makes it sound pretty glamorous. And the period that you're helping to shed light on with the podcast has been so storied over the years, both in documentary work and in fictional films and books. And I just wanted to ask you both what you think the existing literature gets right about what was happening with undercover work at this time and what you think it misses. Ned, do you want to start out?
Well, you know, I took a lot of teasing. Oh, you're going back to the Cayman Islands, you know, down on the beach. And I got to say, it was nothing but stress down there. I had a cooperating witness that was an alcoholic drug addict, constantly threatening suicide, which I couldn't divulge to the FBI because they would shut it down. A guy that could turn, in my view, any minute, he could go to the people in the cartel down there and say, hey, he's an agent. So you had to deal with that. And, you know, there was a lot of pitfalls and also the stress to make it happen, to get results out of it.
To convince people to work with you.
Yeah. You know, I would say only the FBI could have handled this case. We indicted and convicted 300 people. And we used 7 divisions of the FBI in this effort, and everybody worked together. There was no animosity. There was no infighting. It was an incredible team effort.
Right. Jake, what about you? Did you have a different understanding of it now, having heard the actual facts from Ned?
Yeah, it's a great question. Coming in, what I knew was Donnie Brasco, right? Which was both, you know, they showed the danger, but it was definitely glamorized. And also, the Donnie Brasco movie shows this guy who goes undercover with the mob and has a complete firewall between his, like, undercover persona as a mobster and his home life. And I just assume that's the way it was. And what Ned's story shows is that the two bled into one another constantly. In fact, there were times where Ned had some of his biker informants coming back to his actual home with him. Now, bear in mind, his wife was an FBI agent. She has this wonderful line in the podcast where she said she saw these bikers walking up the driveway and her first thought was, oh my God, what will the neighbors think? And so, and I said to him, Ned, like, you know, why? Why would you do that? And he said, I had to build trust with these guys, that my life was in their hands when we were out and vice versa. And I knew that if they knew where I lived and they saw this, that they knew that it was the ultimate act of trust, which I was somewhat skeptical. And then I talked to one of these guys that he brought home, and he said, basically, in simple term, he said, that's what did it for me. So for me, it really was eye-opening, kind of debunking some of the kind of Hollywood myths of undercover work.
Author and podcast producer Jake Halpern has been talking with us today. Also, former Detroit Metro FBI agent Ned Timmons. Their new podcast is called Deep Cover. Gentlemen, it is, the only thing I can say is it's the podcast equivalent of a fantastic summer read. Thank you both so much for talking to us about it, and thanks for the series.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, April.
The first federal execution in almost two decades was carried out today in Indiana. After the break, we'll explore the history of the death penalty in Michigan.
Michigan was unique in the sense that it was the first to abolish capital punishment and stood alone for a long time.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In the wee hours this morning, the Supreme Court allowed a federal death penalty sentence to be carried out. Daniel Lewis Lee was the first federal execution permitted in 17 years. He was put to death this morning at around 8 a.m., claiming until the very end that he was innocent of the murders for which he was convicted. We wanted to talk a bit more about Michigan's history with the death penalty and whether that may change. Richard Broughton is an assistant professor of law at University of Detroit Mercy, and he joins us now. Richard Broughton, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you very much.
Were you very much surprised by the high court's decision when you woke up this morning?
Not surprised at all.
The court's action was to reject a last-minute legal challenge for Daniel Lewis Lee's execution. What is the context in which the justices were viewing what defense attorneys were asking them to consider?
Right. I mean, there were a couple of issues before the court. I think the main issue that the court was dealing with was an issue about the single drug protocol that's being used by the federal government now, the use of this drug, pentobarbital. That drug has actually been raised in a previous case. Actually, last year, the Supreme Court decided a case called Bucklew. It was a Missouri case, not a federal case. But it was also a case in which an inmate was being subjected to a lethal injection using pentobarbital and had gotten that claim all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court rejected Bucklew's claim. And on similar grounds, or for similar reasons, they rejected it here as well. I think that was the primary issue in front of the court. Of course, Lee had raised other claims during the litigation of his case. But I think in terms of the case before the court overnight, that was the primary issue.
In his final statements before he was put to death, Daniel Lewis Lee claimed again that he was innocent and that he was guilty of many things, but not these particular crimes. Whether or not he was speaking the truth, there are studies who've shown that there are plenty of innocent people who have been put to death under death penalty laws. I wanted to get a little bit of context from you about how we talk about whether the death penalty should exist when innocent people have been executed wrongfully.
Sure. Look, the innocence issue is a serious issue, and at least for supporters of capital punishment, it's an issue that they ought to continue to take seriously. I mean, I think one of the arguments that you will hear from those who support capital punishment is that despite these claims of actual innocence, we haven't really had an established case, at least not under the modern death penalty, the contemporary death penalty, of an actually innocent person being executed. Certainly, there are examples of innocent people being sentenced to death, but not actual executions. And so one of the arguments that I think you're going to hear is that, prosecutors are not going to go out looking for innocent people to sentenced to death or to, execute. But that we should let the process work, that we should let the process play out. So I think that's the kind of thing that you're going to hear from supporters of capital punishment. Obviously, abolitionists, those who oppose capital punishment, they raise the innocence argument as one of often many reasons why we should abolish capital punishment. In other words, that the risk is simply too great. If there is a risk that an innocent person could actually be executed, that in their mind would be enough to abolish capital punishment.
One of the cases working its way through the federal courts right now is that of Marvin Gabrion. He was convicted in Michigan, but let's speak a little more broadly first. What is Michigan's history with this punishment?
Right. So Michigan does not have a death penalty as a matter of state law. Michigan abolished the death penalty back in the 1840s. And then by constitutional provision in the 1960s, abolished capital punishment. Now, it's my understanding that even after the abolition in the mid-1840s, Michigan continued to recognize a death penalty possibility for treason against the state. They never had such a case or never had occasion to use it for those purposes. But now the death penalty is completely abolished in Michigan. So if you're a defendant in a state trial in Michigan, even for the most heinous of murders, you would not be eligible for a death penalty under state law. The Gabrion case, of course, is a little bit different because he was convicted in federal court and like Daniel Lewis Lee, was subject to the federal death penalty rather than a state death penalty.
Do you think that there's a reason why the death penalty was such a focus of attention in Michigan at the time when these decisions were made?
I don't know. I don't have any reason to believe anything in particular about the particular debate. My sense is we've long had a debate about capital punishment in this country, and that was true even after the founding of the country. But we've also, for a long time, recognized capital punishment. Michigan was unique in the sense that it was the first to abolish capital punishment. And stood alone for a long time. But my sense is that those involved in this debate at the time in Michigan were, among sort of the more progressive on this issue. And now Michigan doesn't seem like an outlier at all because many states have abolished the death penalty.
Could you foresee a resurgence in the death penalty, or do you think it's inevitable that American society is moving to abolish it entirely?
I don't think there's anything inevitable about abolition. I do think that there has been a steady, though relatively slow, move toward having a less ubiquitous death penalty. I think the death penalty has become narrower. We're going to see fewer executions going forward, I think. But my sense is that at least for the foreseeable future, at least many jurisdictions in the country and likely the federal government will continue to have a death penalty. You take your more active death penalty states like Texas, Florida, Oklahoma, Ohio. Those states, I think, are unlikely to get rid of their death penalty, at least in terms of abolishing it. But I do think that we will continue to see the narrowing of the use of the death penalty. And that'll be true both at the state level and at the federal level. But my sense is, again, at least for the foreseeable future, even if we see a narrowing of the use of the death penalty, we're unlikely to see its complete and total abolition in this country.
Richard, I have one more question for you, and it concerns the case of Marvin Gabrion. He was convicted in 2002 of a truly terrible crime, the murder of Rachel Timmerman, a woman who was scheduled to testify against him. Her infant daughter also disappeared that night, although Gabrion has never confessed to having anything to do with that. This became a federal case because it was believed to have occurred in the Manistee National Forest, which is why there is a defendant from Michigan who is facing the death penalty right now. He's seeking to have his conviction and sentence vacated. Do you think, we have just about less than a minute left, do you think this case poses any special challenges, either because of the boundary issues or because of the intense emotionality that people associate with it?
Well, I think one of the things about the Gabrion case that was the most controversial was the idea that the federal government was seeking the death penalty in a case that was located in a state that didn't have the death penalty as a matter of state law. That's been an issue for a while in sort of death penalty politics and death penalty law. Should the federal government be seeking the death penalty, even though the federal government has a valid death penalty system, should it be seeking death penalties in states that, as a matter of their own state law, the people of that state have abolished? So I think that was really the aspect of the Gabrion case that was the most controversial when this case was first coming through the system. Since then, the federal government has actually sought the death penalty in a number of cases located in states, albeit within federal jurisdiction, but located in states that, as a matter of state law, did not have the death penalty. So that's remained a controversial issue, but the federal government has done this in states beyond Michigan.
Richard Broughton is an assistant professor of law at University of Detroit Mercy. Richard, thank you so much for talking with us about these issues.
Thank you very much.
There was another case at the High Court that got our attention recently. The justices ruled July 9th that a large part of the state of Oklahoma is part of the Muscogee Creek Nation's reservation territory. The case was huge news for tribal sovereignty, but its influence was not limited to Oklahoma. The ruling could affect a lawsuit filed by the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians against the state of Michigan. Matthew Fletcher is a law professor at MSU and director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at the school. He's also a member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. Matthew Fletcher, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
When we hear that the Supreme Court declared that much of the eastern half of Oklahoma is considered reservation land belonging to the Muscogee Creek Nation, what does that actually mean? Does it substantially change things for members of the tribe there?
It kind of doesn't. The main thing is it has to do with who would prosecute felonies, you know, major crimes, we call them, in Indian law. So tribal members that normally otherwise would have been prosecuted by Oklahoma, who are now in Indian country within a reservation, would be prosecuted by the federal government or potentially the tribe itself.
This is a longstanding and kind of bitter issue across many different kinds of communities and many different kinds of tribal communities. Could you maybe fill us in on why the stakes have been so high for who's going to prosecute what when crimes happen across tribal land?
Well, one of the reasons this case reached the Supreme Court is that one of the defendants at issue is actually on death row in Oklahoma. And normally, Indian country murders do not result in a capital punishment prosecution. The federal government usually, not always, but usually will defer to a tribe's wishes on whether or not it wants to seek the death penalty for a serious murder. And so that's one of the key aspects to this case, is that Oklahoma had put one of the defendants on death row. The other aspects are sort of amorphous. They're more symbolic, more than anything. So if you look at Oklahoma's list of grievances about why it would be a problem for big swaths of its territory to be considered Indian country, and you really drill down into what they're talking about, they're talking about the possibility of maybe the Federal Environmental Protection Agency having more jurisdiction over some of the oil and gas activities in that area. They're talking about some tax things, but it's really very amorphous and really nonspecific as to what the impacts could be. And there is a lot of fear-mongering related to a case like this. And this is not, and Oklahoma is not unique. Other places do the same thing when they are confronted with reservation boundaries cases.
What was your reaction when you got a look at the decision?
Well, I thought it was amazing. Justice Gorsuch's opinion talked about how tribes have suffered through broken promises in their treaties. He talked about how Oklahoma's complaints were overstated. He talked about how really Indian people and tribes have gone through a lot of torment over the centuries, really, and it was only fair to treat them fairly and normally in this context, and to respect the promises that the United States has made to tribes. And you occasionally will see language like that in an opinion, but for the most part, the Supreme Court rarely ever talks about the tribe's understanding of a treaty or the tribe's understanding of federal and state laws, and really just focuses on how a tribe's assertion of rights or interests will affect non-Indians. This was one of the rare, maybe the only times where the court actually paid attention to and gave respect to how a case like this would impact Indian people.
Let's shift gears over to the Little Traverse Bay Band's lawsuit against Michigan's state government. Their claim concerns a treaty that was signed in 1855. And they're seeking 300 acres of land. Can you give us a little background on this case and how they came to file it?
Well, the 1855 treaty is an unusual treaty in that it establishes a reservation through a process called allotment. And so what it is that normally a reservation, you just carve off a bunch of areas, an area of law or a parcel of land, and you say, tribe, this is your reservation. And later on, Congress might come in and carve up that reservation and start giving it away or selling it off to other people. And that's when you have these reservation diminishment cases. But with Little Traverse, the United States never actually did that. They never actually surveyed the reservation. They never actually did implemented the treaty in any meaningful way. So Indian people never got the lands they were promised. And most of that land went directly to non-Indians without ever passing through Indian ownership. And so the big similarity between the McGirt case and the Little Traverse case that I can see is that both were involved this process of allotment, which is a complicated process that's a little bit different than just creating a reservation and saying, tribe, you own it all by yourself, do whatever you want with it. Allotment means that individual tribal members own the reservation. So that happened at Little Traverse, and that happened also with the McGirt case, the Muscogee Creek Reservation. So there's a similarity there between the two. But the main difference between those two cases is that Little Traverse's case, they never actually got their lands, whereas the Muscogee Creek Nation members did get their lands. And so in some ways, the Little Traverse case is a much more sympathetic case, but a much more difficult case in terms of impacts to consider from the point of view of non-members, non-Indians.
Now, the most recent history on this is last August, a federal judge ruled that the 1855 treaty did not create a reservation, and that decision is what's now on appeal at the Sixth Circuit level. How do you see the McGirt decision impacting that appeal?
Well, it really has a lot to do with the methodology of how courts reason these cases, these reservation boundaries cases. Until the McGirt case, it was possible for states, in the federal government on occasion, and non-members to say, well, you know, maybe you had a reservation boundary, and maybe it's still there, but too many people have moved into the area, too much land has gone out of Indian ownership, and because of the weight of history, I'm sorry, your reservation is gone. Now, if we take the McGirt opinion by its word, that analysis is irrelevant. Justice Gorsuch said it doesn't matter what happened to the reservation after it was created. All that matters is Congress can create the reservation, and only Congress can divest a tribe of its reservation, not the passage of time, not the weight of history, not land ownership or the demographics of the reservation residents. And if that's the case, it could potentially really upset the decision in the Little Traverse case made by the trial court.
Matthew Fletcher is director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University. Matthew, thanks for laying out the issues for us, and safe travels.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.